Hi, welcome to Off Script. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Today on the show, it's a numbers episode, Andy. We got Exit 8, a Japanese horror film based on a video game from director Genki Kawamura. Odd kind of loop horror psychological thing where somebody's stuck in one place and can't get out. Really cool time. Very excited to talk about Exit 8. I was hesitant. I'm very glad we watched it. Stick around for the review. We're also going to take a look at Crime 101, a crime thriller that came out on Amazon Prime a few weeks ago. Chris Hemsworth, Mark Ruffalo, Halle Berry, Barry Keoghan. It's a good time. Excited to talk about it. Coming from American Animals director Bart Layton, his first film in 8 years. It's a heist movie. It's a crime movie. It's exciting. Stick around for the review on Crime 101. We're going to take a quick look at some TV. I know I got a thing for this somewhere. Invincible Season 4, Boys Season 5. Talk a little about Euphoria, a little about Beef. Season 2 coming to Netflix shortly. Andy's going to be kind of running, quarterbacking that one?
Running point.
Yeah, sure. That's what we're going to be doing. Before we get to everything, we got to take a look at the news. Our first story this week from the horror sector. Osgood Perkins has a Long Legs movie coming. Another Long Legs movie. And he's doing a thing with Nicolas Cage. They're making a horror universe, maybe. What do you know about this?
So this just came out yesterday, that news of Osgood Perkins, who of course did 2023's Long Legs, is going to have not a sequel film, but another film in the Long Legs universe, the LCU, I guess, is as you're calling it. It will have will also star Nicolas Cage. And what's really strange is it's not a sequel to the first film. It might take place within, but it also does not involve Michael Monroe, Agent Harker, who was in the first film. That was a huge sensation. It was made for like $5 to $10 million, went on to make over 100, like huge indie, or size of an indie budget. But what's different about this one is that it's being produced by Paramount, which the original Long Legs was produced by in coordination with Neon. So it's probably going to be much bigger. They're going to get the Paramount budget, everything, just more money on the thing. Interesting thing, like I said, it's not a sequel, it's not a follow-up, maybe it's a prequel of some sort. I don't know, but I'm excited about this. I'm a big fan of Osgood Perkins.
Yeah, we covered Long Legs when it came out. You can check our review on the channel, as well as Keeper and The Monkey when those both came out. We had some horror heads right into the show that were quite cross that we were warm on Long Legs. I definitely remember people being like, what do you mean? Like, Long Legs is lame and boring and nothing happens. And then The Monkey came out and people were harsh on that too for wholly different reasons. And then Keeper was like kind of its own thing and even smaller than those two features. Been a funny journey with Osgood Perkins' filmography as of late. But either way, I think out of those three, Long Legs is probably the strongest. With Nick Cage there, I think that kind of helps get some things moving in production. Starts getting people interested, like Amazon, who maybe want to cut in on this. I don't know what you do in it. I guess you got Nick Cage being the weird rocker guy again, right? That's going to be an important part of it. I don't think Micah Monroe comes back, right? Even though she's really cool in that first movie. I don't know. What's happening in the new Long Legs movie? Prequel, I guess? That's got to be a move.
A lot of people had thought that it was going to be Agent Lee Harker going on in kind of like a True Detective style, where she would be going not on adventures, solving different crimes, mysteries, that would kind of make more sense. Instead, we're getting something else, and Nick Cage is still involved. So, like, is he still playing Long Legs? Is he playing another criminal, maybe, or another like kind of crazy character? We don't really know. But like, this is again part of a universe, so they maybe will make more of these films in the LCU. We have yet to see.
I gotta revisit Long Legs. Yeah, I remember being surprised people were like, no, it's bad. I was like, what? I thought, I don't know. It's got a lot of style in there. I don't know. It's
big cool fan stuff. Here as well.
Yeah, come on. Let's talk about Cannes. So we got kind of some news out of Cannes that is interesting. Andy was telling me about this before we got started, because I was like, what exactly are we covering here? Kind of an odd representation this year. Not a lot of American directors at Cannes, but big art house heavy stuff. So if you're into bold cinema like we are, a lot of exciting things coming down the pipe. What do people have to look forward to?
Well, a lot. And I want to just refresh people's memory of the Cannes Film Festival. that happens every May at the end of May, and it's where we get a lot of big indie premieres, a lot of films that will go on to eventually be nominated for Best Picture. A lot of awards contenders come out. This is where things like It Was Just an Accident or Titan or Anatomy of a Fall, these kinds of things debut. So we have a long list of films and directors premiering. Very distinctly, there's not a lot of American representation here. A lot of times the big studios have used Cannes to premiere like a big film like Indiana Jones 5, Horizon, Megalopolis. So one of these kinds of things to kind of kick off and get some star power on the red carpet. And there's no big studio movie kind of premiering this year. You might have something like The Mandalorian or Grogu might have been, I don't know what you do. I think to Top Gun Maverick maybe, but it was like a chance for studios to kind of flex a little bit and get a little bit of publicity. That hasn't really worked very well because the movies they've debuted, like we just named, have not been particularly good. So they don't get a big boost from Cannes. It's also very expensive to go out there and get stars to show up. So we're kind of starless and we don't have a big studio film. Instead, what we have are a series of familiar indie house favorites. So I'm going to go through a list of some of the highlights, starting in competition, because that's what this is. The Man I Love by Ira Sachs, Fatherland by Pavel Pavlikowski, who we loved his film Cold War from 2017-2018. Fatherland also stars Sandra Hüller, who, of course, was in Anatomy of a Fall. And
Hail Mary last week, yeah.
Right, yeah, just powerhouse of actor. Sheep in the Box by Hirokazu Koreeda, which is a name that I know, but I realize I haven't actually seen any of his films, but he's someone who's active in this space. Ryusuke Hamaguchi's follow-up to Drive My Car called All of a Sudden. And again, what's just exciting is just the directors who are premiering films. Like, we're big fans of their work, and now we're seeing the follow-up. Pedro Almodovar, who's worked in this space for 30 years, with a film called Bitter Christmas. What do you think of these in-competition films?
Well, there's definitely some I don't know. Some stuff I've kind of heard and familiar with, like Pawlikowski with Cold War. Pawlikowski, yeah, I'm saying that right, I think. It's fine.
It's a V. Pawlikowski.
Pawlikowski. God, it is. Ryusuke Hamaguchi is the one I'm probably most excited about. Drive My Car rocks. I saw that in theater. We were lucky to see it in theater here in when we covered it on the show. Got the Blu-ray when I could. I think that movie's really cool. Very late title card drop in that movie. Everybody forgets about it. Very cool. And Almodovar's next project is exciting. All good. Like you said, not a lot of American representation. Like, boy, definitely no Mission Impossible, no Indiana Jones 5, no Disney, like, flopping with, like, something they think is going to be cool. They're definitely steering clear this year. Notably, though, we are getting some representation from Jane Schoenbrunn and Steven Soderbergh, right?
That's right. So Jane Schoenbrunn's follow-up to I Saw the TV Glow, which was, like, an indie sensation a couple of years. Their follow-up, Teenage Sex and Death at Camp Miasma, which is a mouthful of a title, that's going to be premiering. That's a huge jump. They went from a big, kind of a quiet premiere of the I Saw the TV Glow to now a Cannes premiere. That's massive. This is the one that stars Hannah Einbinder and Gillian Anderson in something where someone is remaking a Friday the 13th-esque kind of camp slasher. A lot more going on in that film. Very excited for that, but really excited that that's getting a Cannes premiere. Steven Soderbergh has a Beatles thing, John Lennon, The Last Interview. That'll be big for Beatles fans. And Ron Howard has a new film called Avedon, which I don't know anything about. Ron Howard is washed. Another noted enemy of the show is, well, Ron Howard hasn't made a good film in a long time. He also helped a certain person become vice president, so... not on my favorites list, but
that's right. Yeah, that guy sucks.
But these are premiering on the In Certain Regard category, which is out of competition, but still kind of a special place.
Yeah. Also, Soderbergh doing some weird stuff with AI. I keep reading about that. We'll probably cover that more on the show when it comes around, but like both in odd places. Very excited for Schoenbrunn. I love that they're putting out a film called Teenage Sex and Death at Camp Miasma. I'm afraid if I say it too many times on here, we're going to get demonetized. But I love that that's like kind of the big leader here. It's really exciting. I saw TV Glow is kind of an amazing movie, man. I not that long ago, I think I put it on my top 10 of the decade. Like, I think that movie is something really special. Two more, right? Can premiere and then out of competition.
Right, John Travolta is premiering his directorial debut, I think, for a film called Propeller, One Way Night Coach. No idea what this is about. He's into airplanes, so maybe it's a little bit of a autobiography kind of thing. We'll see what that's all about. And then Nicholas Winding Refn, who, of course, is well-known for 2011's Drive, which is a classic now, also Only God Forgives and The Neon Demon, as well as some TV shows. He's been the showrunner of, has a new film called Her Private Hell, starring the great Sophie Thatcher that we love on this show. Really excited for that as well. Always an event when Winding Refn has a new film.
Cannes is running from the 12th to the 23rd. We're on day three as of recording right now. So we'll probably cover it a bit more next week, along with CinemaCon that's kind of happening right now. Let me tell you, it is a special time to be a film head on the internet and not have access to cool trailers and cool things that people are seeing. You just have to read articles about them that are chock full of ads. So, you know, it's a weird time, but we're going to have more. Keep it on off script for more on this stuff, because we're going to cover it and come back to it and tell you what's worth watching and what's not worth watching. Otherwise, any other news out of Cannes?
I know that they will be adding more films to this list as we get closer. Again, it's about a month away. Happens at the end of May. And so these lists were subject to change. Something might get pulled. Some things might be submitted last minute. So we won't know until like the day of, basically.
Right. I'm an idiot. When it said May on the article, I thought March and thought it was happening right now. Andy's right. It's happening in like 60 days. So disregard that. We're going to cover this more when it comes around. Keep it here on Oscar for more for Cannes when it happens. We got to talk about AMC Stubs, man. They're charging more again. it's last price hike was 11 months ago. Now they're hitting us again. What's the damage, Andy?
AMC Scrubs. Oh, wow. A-list.
That's good. I like AMC Scrub. I might make the thumbnail. Probably not. Yeah, no, that's good. I like that.
It's being raised another $2 to $29.90, $30 a month now for the subscription. That's kind of a lot, but you get four. You can see four films a week, which is more than anyone goes. I've never seen that many in a week, more than enough for most people if you're close to an AMC. So it's still a good deal if you're a constant moviegoer, but still getting kind of pricey. We're still Cinemark filmgoers here, holding the line at $8.99, and just cheaper concessions. I feel like AMC concessions are really expensive. So even if the film going is a deal, that you're going to pay at the concession side.
Yeah.
And they have a couple of other, you get some upgrades on popcorn and drinks, but yeah, like the prices just keep going up.
There's such a funny value equation, like with any subscription service, and it's so difficult to nail down what exactly is and isn't working for everybody. I was just reading an article earlier this week about Microsoft's Game Pass video game subscription service. And last year, they just straight doubled the price one day. They said, hey, 50% increase. We're just ripping the Band-Aid off, right? And a ton of people left. And now they're kind of figuring out what that's going to mean for them in the future, because it didn't seem like a good idea. AMC, instead, is kind of, what do you call it? Death by a thousand cuts. Lots of little increases. And $2 here and $3 there doesn't seem like too much. But bringing it up to $30 a month is pretty costly, man. That's pretty steep. That's a couple of subscription services for sure. I think it's still got value in the in the turns. All right, you get the IMAX and Dolby upgrades for free. So if you live near an AMC with an IMAX screen, that's a bump for nothing, which is pretty cool. You also get free upgrades on popcorn and drinks, and I think you get a $5 credit for every $50 spent. So, like, I think if you go a lot and you go for those premium formats and you're going for concessions, it's still good. But yeah, dude, like, we go see four films a week, four films a month at the movies. And, like, that's barely worth it for where we're going. Like, I'm a fan of, like, matinees. Those are already cheap, you know, cheap seats. And the crowds are smaller anyway. I don't know. I think the value equation is maxing out for me. If I was an AMC Stubs member, I'd be questioning where I'm at, $30 a month, but maybe it still works. If you're listening to this, you're listening to this show and this still works, write in the show, mail at oscarfilmreview.com. Please tell us. We'll cover it next week. I want to hear your story, because I just, I don't know, man. It's tight.
Yeah, tell us if you're an AMC Scrubs A-list member.
Yeah, please. Member. AMC Scrubs. God,
yeah.
There'd be a lot of people.
I mean, I think it's one of these things where you're selling the potential. You're like the potential of, oh, you can go see four movies a week. No one has seen that many. I've never seen that much. You know, even if you go once a week, it's still, you know, it's going to come out cheaper probably than some others, but man, it's still climbing a lot. And I don't like that you're kind of tied to one theater. Sometimes I have to go outside of Cinemark if I want to see something because it's not playing at my local one, and end up having to go somewhere else anyways. And if you have to do that and you're already paying $30 a month, then the price just kind of keeps going up.
Yeah, it's real limited use case, I think. And the further you live from the theater, like the more limited it is. I hear a lot on Twitter about AMC and New York doing well, right? They got what, Lincoln Square location or something that's like within walking or transit distance. Sure. Or if you go a couple times a day, man, there's some people who will just double feature. Like, I see it. I know there's a couple folks who listen to the show who've written in before who told me they're still on it. I don't know. It's just, it's getting up there. It's how I feel about Amazon Prime. Like, Amazon Prime's getting to a point where, like, I just don't know if this is still worth it. Things take longer. It's not as good. Six and one, half dozen the other. Totally different things. I got to move on from A-list. Any other thoughts on this before we jump into box office?
No, I'm ready to go.
Super Mario is killing it. And also Hail Mary continuing to do well with a late return to IMAX theaters. Big surprise there. How are things looking at the box office?
The Super Mario Galaxy movie held on for, I think it just had about a 30% drop at just under 70 million domestically for the weekend and a massive 628 million globally. It's going to be a billion-dollar movie again. It's probably going to make around what the first movie did. It's just a powerhouse of cinema. No surprise there. Project Hail Mary also hanging on in its third week, I believe, which crossed the $500 million mark. Big success there, 24.6 million domestically. So our two big movies of the year are doing really well, and they're doing way better. I think the box office is up like 23% from this time last year. So we're not back because we've never really been back since COVID, but it's looking a lot better this year than kind of the past few years.
IMAX is in a funny place right now, and they basically like are suffering from abundance. Like, they have so many films that want to premiere in that large format and charge people a bundle for tickets that they are suffering like too many scheduling conflicts. And one of these big ones was with Hail Mary, which came out in 70 millimeter at what, 15 locations across the United States. That's how we saw it. 70 millimeter IMAX, very exciting. It was out in theaters for a couple weeks. 24 hours, round the clock, sold out shows. They could not keep people from buying seats, like just insanely popular in that format. And then Super Mario comes out and it's just like, hit the brakes. Suddenly we're not doing 24 hour shows anymore. We're not filling seats as quickly. So surprisingly, in a pivot I didn't expect, IMAX announced they were bringing Hail Mary back to theaters, back to IMAX screens 1 week after Mario and starting to intersperse it. We have a local one in town that's running the 70 millimeter again just this next week. And Chris and I got tickets. I think we're going to go see it again Sunday morning. So that's going to help that movie push over 600 million global, which is a big deal because it seemed like when Amazon was pulling it out just a couple weeks ago, I was like, what are you doing? Oh my God, the sun is shining. Your film is making money. Like, keep it going. So they're going to keep juggling the ball and it's going to stay up and Hail Mary is going to push over the top. Exciting for them. Super Mario, like Andy said, is making a billion. That's my Hail Mary story. What else is going on at the box office?
Well, real quick, but before I move on, I was also going to say it's a big win for Amazon MGM. This is like kind of their first really big foray into a huge studio kind of blockbuster-esque film, Project Hail Mary, that is. It was an expensive film, almost $200 million. Everyone was kind of scratching their heads and they're like, this, you're putting $200 million on this? There's no way. And now it's become a sensation. So now like they've established themselves as like a legitimate kind of Hollywood studio. Like, if they've done this once, then they can, you know, see what their next huge big budget studio thing is going to be. So that's exciting. The drama came in third place with 8.7 million also hanging on. It's made 62 million globally. That film cost about 30 million to make, so it's doing really well. It's going to hit profit territory really soon. And it's been one of the films that's kind of been provocative. It's garnered a lot of discussion and online posting and rants and things like that. So kind of one of the first big movies of the year that's been really just something that everyone is talking about. In fourth place came Yumi in Tuscany, which was the new rom-com set in the Italian countryside with Regé-Jean Page and Halle Bailey. A little underperforming, but it's in the top five, which I think is good. And then Hoppers has also done really well, which has now made over $350 million globally, and it came in 4.1 million domestically. This is also a big success for Disney Pixar. I think it was cheaper than the average Pixar movie at only $100 million. So it's doing really well for that size of budget.
Really glad to hear Yumi and Tuscany's got an A- cinema score and is boasting generally strong audience exits. Just kind of looks like a generic rom-com to me. Reminds me a lot of like Anyone But You, with Sydney Sweeney and Glenn Powell from just a couple years ago, but seems to be a good time. So if you're into those movies, like, go check it out. I don't know if we'll end up covering it on the pod. Probably not, but you know, maybe. Hey, we watch rom-coms every now and again. As for Hoppers, glad to hear that movie's doing well. When we covered that a few weeks ago, we were kind of all skeptical because it's a Pixar original and those seem to be struggling as of late. But we covered it and said it was going to be a hit, and it sure is. So if you want to stay ahead of what is and isn't working at the movies, you know, hit the subscribe button or whatever, like, follow, come back next week. We cover this stuff every week, and we're always right about it. Any other thoughts on the box office, Andy?
No, I don't think I'm ready for a review.
We got to move on to Exit 8. I'm going to be taking the summary on this, so please excuse any funny delivery. The film is Exit 8. So it's a funny time in horror at the movies right now. I think we're at a funny intersection of traditional stuff and analog stuff and lo-fi stuff. And additionally, we have a lot of creators stepping into the space coming from uncommon places like YouTube or video games or the internet. And that's kind of where Exit 8 comes from. A film based on a video game about a young man who gets lost in a subway station in Japan. Japanese film from director Genki Kawamura, and I know it's based on a game that I have not played and Andy has not played, but even still, the film is simple. 90 minutes and not many sets. A man gets off a train at the beginning when he receives some surprising news, and he begins to make his way through the train station when he suddenly discovers that it's a loop and loops back on itself, and if he tries to go the other way, he comes back out the other end. Think Neo getting stuck in the train station in The Matrix 3, except a little bit bigger and a little bit more drawn out. It seems like one guy stuck in a place who can't escape would not be a captivating film, but alas, Exit 8 brings something special to it. Rules. We discover that there are these anomalies, things that change in each loop as he walks through the subway station. Little things like a sign that's a different color, or a doorknob that may be moved from the left to the right, maybe a vent that isn't there, or sometimes things that are odd or strange, unsettling, frightening even. And as our man attempts to escape the train station, look for the eighth and final exit, things become more and more unsettling. It's a bottle film, and typically these are hard to pull off because you're not really going anywhere and it's a small budget. And being a foreign film, you additionally are going to be reading some subtitles, right? Some things in culture may not transfer over perfect, but let me tell you, Exit 8 is a delight. It is very cool, and there are some very cool tricks happening in here. I think it's a good preamble to A24's The Backrooms, coming out soon from director Kane Parsons. It's kind of similar, comes from a different place. I think Exit 8's really cool, and I'm really excited to talk about it. Andy, what did you think of Exit 8?
So I saw a post that I think encapsulates this film really well, which was the first 30 minutes are in danger of becoming really repetitive, and then it gets an incredible second wind through the film. And that's exactly how I felt, where I thought it was cool when it started, but I was very worried that I was like, is it going to be like Until Dawn or the escape room movies, where it's like you're just trying to do what's on the side of the box, and there's ends up being so much more in this. It ends up being a character study of someone's essential fear of fatherhood. We first hear him take a call as he's going into the subway with his girlfriend. He ignores it a few times. Eventually, she tells him that she's pregnant, and they're kind of debating what to do about it, whether they're going to keep it or not. And that's kind of, he gets that call, and then he goes, gets stuck in this loop. And while it is, we do have the fun horror stuff of like trying to escape this endless hallway, it's also this really profound character study, which I didn't think it would be, and it works so well. It has a lot of good creepy, so it's not super scary, but it has a lot of good like spooky, creepy moments. It's also, it's not too long. It's 90 minutes, wraps up the story. Because even as good as it gets, if it were 2 hours long, I don't think it would work as well. So the brief run time really helps it. And overall, I really enjoyed it. And I didn't really know what to think initially.
Yeah, Exudate's kind of central device seems like it would overstay its welcome, but it doesn't because of the way it's filmed. It's a lot of one-ers, and most of them are blended together pretty seamlessly. Like, you can see the edges if you're looking for them, for sure. If you're into kind of the craft of movie making and you're really got an eye out for it, you can see where kind of things blend. But there's a lot of long, uninterrupted sequences, and when you're walking through these hallways and they start to loop over and over again, you, the viewer, start to look for these anomalies. You start to look for the things that are out of place. And every time he cranks back around to the beginning of the next one, you see the sign light up that says, hey, you're on level 2 or level 3. You're making it. You're making progress. Your eye starts to dart around and look for the posters and look for the doors and look at this one guy that keeps walking down with this briefcase who is just very odd. And like, you, the viewer, really get engrossed in like spotting the illusion, spotting the break. And that, I think, is really effective when you don't have a lot of cuts. It becomes hypnotizing. You get pulled into it. And as we start to kind of go and make progress and things start to get stranger and stranger, somehow, instead of shying away from the horror and leaning away from the screen and wanting to pull the covers up over your eyes, you want to see it before it sees you. And that like really brings you in to Exit 8 in a way that is so effective. And also, it's not long. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Wait, 2 hours have been way too much for this. 90 is like perfect. Just makes it where it's like doesn't overstay its welcome, not too long. And I love the way it like flips the script on like how horror works. You're not scared of what's coming. You're like looking into it because you want to see what's wrong and he needs to double back or go forward.
Right. Yeah, like I said, it establishes our rules. It sets things up, but then it also kind of wrong foots you a little bit. It gets you, you know, places you in the driver's seat. Also, you know, because he starts like naming the posters. He counts the wall on the right because he's like door, vent, fire extinguisher, vent. Like he kind of goes through it in his mind. But you're also like, was that different last time? Or not, like and there's also a creepy guy who's walking through that he passes, and he tries to interact with and just ignores him. This becomes a constant thing. And then when we shift it, we end up shifting to different perspectives, three different people, which is really interesting as well. So I think I was really surprised. Again, such a simple premise and like small, simple set, and yet it does so much with it.
A lot like Backrooms, I like Exit 8's theme of like being trapped in some kind of like corporate modern society hell, right? Like we are trapped in this fluorescent light lit like white tile subway station with advertisements and maintenance doors and the idea that we're going somewhere, something that's been put together by society, this kind of puzzle box, this like labyrinth or maze of our own making, and how our lost man like has a cell phone that like mostly works. Like he can't really use it to make calls after a while, but like can try to take photos, use a flashlight. Like he can use the tools that are at his disposal. It doesn't just go for some cop out like, oh no, my battery's dead. In fact, the phone is a bit more of a device, I think, than just, I don't know, a surface level flashlight. If you really start to look at it, there's a sequence where it gets cracked that comes up later. Like, there's a lot going on in here. And like Andy said, there's kind of this element of like struggles of fatherhood and like the notion of parentage that is like kind of interesting. Just enough sewn in there on top of like this simple concept from a video game that's just like walk this hallway. And when you see something weird, run back. And if everything looks good, continue forward. Easy, simple, but like, I don't know, doesn't try to be too big, doesn't try to bite off more than it can chew. It seems like a simple premise because it is, and it ends up being a delightful little psychological thriller. Yeah, not as scary as I would have thought either. I figured it was really going to lean in, like big jump scares and stuff. But no, it kind of respects its viewer. It's not there to hurt your feelings. Yeah, I think XH is like real sharp all around.
Yeah, I think part of what helps it is that we have really good performances from our lead, Kazunori Ninomiya, who is the lost man, who's the first person we meet who is stuck in this loop, and who also he has asthma, and he's like struggling to get his inhaler a lot. Like this becomes a plot point, but he has to do, again, a lot of one takes. The very opening is actually first person. You're in first person for a little bit, which I was really worried about. I thought the whole film was going to be like that, and I don't think that would have worked for me, but I was luckily it's not. But he's got to do a ton of acting. It's only him on screen for the longest time. And then our other supporting characters, Yamato Kochi, who plays the walking man, also gets a segment dedicated to him. He has a very kind of like, he looks like a businessman. He's got this smile that's a little bit too big and too plastered on, that's really creepy. A couple of other actors that show up as well. But our performances are also part of what make this work so well.
I want to start to wrap up kind of where we're at with Exit 8. I think we both are big fans of what's happening here, and I'm excited to get to recommendations. But before I do, a quick note from the director, Genki Kawamura. He's done one other feature film called 100 Flowers in 2022, which seemed to have been rated fine. I haven't seen it. And then Exit 8 just a few years later here in 2025, shot it last year. I hope he does more. There's something cool going on here. Like there's kind of some special things happening, and it's not perfect. A lot of it is a pastiche of things you've seen before. But X8 is clever. And while it's based on a video game, it seems like it'd be really simple. Like, I think it's delightful for people who are looking for something like this. Analog horror heads. I think there's something really cool here. With that, any other thoughts or recommendations, Andy?
I'm ready.
Would you recommend X8?
Yes, I absolutely would. Had a lot of fun with this. It's a small, spooky bottle film that has a lot more to it than you might think. I've been recommending it to everyone that I know, horror fans, film fans. It's creepy. It's spooky. We have great performances from our leads. Like I said, it's a character study. There's a lot more going on than just the kind of the surface level premise that we get. This was a lot of fun. Highly recommend.
Yeah, Exit 8 rocks. A man is trapped in a subway station, and every loop he goes through, things get weirder and weirder. It's creepy. It's thrillery. It's a lot of fun. Doesn't overstay its welcome in 90 minutes. Exit 8 rocks. Go check out Exit 8 for sure. If you like analog horror, I don't know, low budget horror, this thing's really clever. Totally worth your time. Check out Exit 8. I wish I could tell you a streamer to check it out on. I think it's on VOD. Like that'd be the place to see it. But otherwise, we should move on to what else is on streaming in a segment that's not dedicated to film, but other cinematic things. Andy, what do we call this segment?
It's time for the TV corner. And we're going to be catching up on several shows that are either starting or have kind of been playing for a few weeks. The very first one, Invincible, which is probably one of my favorite shows ever, kind of subversive superhero show. Episode 7 just wrapped up last night, and it was incredible. And it's been a really fun season. There's been, I don't think it really any lows. People were complaining about episode 4, which is an original episode, something not in the comic books. That was a little bit of a filler. It's still a lot of fun, but the last three episodes, episodes 5, 6, and 7, have absolutely cooked. No slider, all gas. Like, it's been so good. One of my favorite shows, really enjoying it. The Boys season 5 also finally kicked off just last week. So it's through, I think 3 episodes are out. I've seen the first 2. This show has just been going for too long. Like, they should have wrapped this up years ago. They stretched it out with Gen V, the college kind of version of the show, a couple of seasons of that. And when we get back to this first episode, all our characters had been half of them had been captured at the end of season 4, and they are subsequently freed at the beginning of season 5. And it just kind of, it feels like they've been in prison for 10 minutes because of that. And also, I was like having to remind myself of like, who's friends with who? Who's beefing with who? Who's romantically involved?
Yeah,
I couldn't really remember, and I also don't really care. I'm like, oh, like they're trying to show like this sweet relationship, and I was like, this has just been done to death. Like, can we wrap this up? There's a kind of a tragic moment in the first episode, and again, I was like, I don't care. I don't remember this character's arc. I don't remember where they were at the end of last season. Like, this has just been going on for too long. The second episode is better, I thought, but it's still just like, it's just old hat. It should have finished in season 4.
Yeah, I think I kind of fell off of watching both of these shows, so maybe not the best position to talk about TV corner, but also I think that's a reflection of a lot of folks. Like, there's people who started watching these and kind of fell off. I'm glad to hear Invincible still keeping it up, and for what it's worth, I think The Boys is too. I think I just kind of lulled because I don't know. I was in the beginning of a slow season. I watched a lot of movies for the podcast. Kind of the same reason for Invincible. Like, I just don't keep up with TV as well as I should. Invincible, I think the reason I struggle is because, like many animated shows, particularly anime, animation is expensive, and you can't have big, flashy action explosions every single minute of every single episode. There's got to be episodes where people just hang out and talk in a room. And boy, I just feel like I fall apart and struggle with that stuff. And sometimes you get slow episodes, odd episodes. Anyway, pacing can be a struggle for me. Meanwhile, boys, I love Homelander. I think Homelander is like one of the coolest comic book to screen villains ever. I think he's amazing. But dog, you cannot have the same villain for like five seasons. Like, it's just too long. It's an overstayed welcome. An amazing character who I love, who I just have not been able to keep up with. Throw in Gen V, it starts to feel like homework. I feel like this is a reflection of a lot of viewers, right? I think the, both of these shows share a similar problem that way. It's difficult to keep juggling the whole time, keep the plate spinning for all audiences. Fortunately, there's folks like you out there who are willing to stay up late and watch the brand new episode and miss the spoilers and start the hype train for the rest of us.
Yeah, the Boys started in 2019, and you know, we've been going for 7 years with this series, and everyone looks so much older. Like, a couple of actors have had drastic weight loss, weight changes. Jack Quaid, who was great as Huey in the first season, because he's this like bright eyed young ingenue, almost like very naive, and now he just like kind of looks middle aged because it's just been going for so long. Like, he doesn't look like that kind of teenage bright eyed kid anymore. And it's again, same villain in every season. It's just like, oh, we're going to kill Homelander. Oh, he got away again for rats. Like now or the fifth time.
Yeah.
So this is the final season, definitely needs to wrap up, but they are going to be doing a prequel series called, Vought Rising that takes place 30, 50 years, in the past with characters like Stormfront and, Soldier Boy. Right? Played by Jensen Ackles. I don't know if I'm going to be watching that. I'll have to see. If there's nothing else on, I will, but
listen,
I'm kind of done. I'm done with the Boys, I think.
That's the other angle. Yeah, old Supernatural heads know that the show Supernatural on the CW that ended up running for like 14 seasons, right? It was created by Eric Kripke, starred Jensen Ackles and Jared Padalecki and Misha Collins in the later seasons. Eric Kripke produces The Boys here on Amazon, and this has kind of been his big project, moving off of Supernatural for 14 seasons. So you've started to see some DNA of that show wind in here, in particular with its casting of Jensen Ackles as Soldier Boy. I think in this season, Jared Padalecki and Misha Collins both make an appearance. There's a couple other actors that have appeared in the show as well. One character appears as a senator. I used to watch that show, not religiously. I only kept up through like the first, I was like a 5-season Supernatural watcher and then fell off and then tried to keep up with the rest and the angels and the it's a whole thing. But I think there's a lot of that in here. So if you were tied into that fandom and then you managed to stumble into The Boys and appreciate the tonal shift from like broadcast television, you know, Monster of the Week horror to like R-rated adult The Boys, I think you love what's happening. And Vault Rising is like an immediate extension of that thing, right? Oh my God, it's going to be Kripke and Jared and Jensen Ackles. They're going to be doing their thing. That's going to be sick. Like, don't get me wrong. Love all those guys. But that is another way in which I feel a little out in the cold here. It's like not quite homework, but it's just a corner of it I shouldn't know as well as I do. What else have you been watching, Andy? Have you watched a new season of Euphoria?
I have not, but I did want to talk about it a little bit. I never got into this show. This, of course, started in 2019. Written and directed by Sam Levinson, that helped kick off the careers of such names as Zendaya, Sydney Sweeney, Jacob Elordi, and more. This show took a big hiatus between seasons 2 and 3, and this show has also done a big time jump. I don't know what's going on in the show, and I'm kind of not interested in watching it, but it is one of the biggest shows out there, so I wanted to talk about it just a little bit. Yeah. Like I said, we see a big time jump in our characters. And the thing is, I just haven't heard very good things about Sam Levinson. A lot of people have accused him of like writing all his women as sex workers or sex worker adjacent, and they all get abused and beat up and things like this. So a lot of people are kind of against this show, but it is one of the biggest shows for HBO. So it is on, from what I've heard from the first season, the best thing I saw was like, I hated it, I'll be there next Sunday. It's kind of the sentiment. So I think if you're into it, I think it does pull you in. We found our characters. The show took place in high school in the first two seasons, and now they're actually post-college. now, so that's helped with our actors aging up. Like I said, I'm not interested in getting, and I don't want to go back and watch the first two seasons either. I sat through The Idol, which was one of Sam Levinson's shows that was also kind of terrible and didn't know what kind of show it was trying to be. So that's kind of where we are on Euphoria. Do you know any thoughts on Euphoria?
No, I cannot tell you how funny I think it is that we positioned it on here to talk about it. We're both like, haven't watched it, don't care. Well, who cares, right? No, I don't know anything about Euphoria. All I know is it's got a stellar cast, like you said. Like, you got Zendaya, Jacob Elordi, Sydney Sweeney, and Hunter Schafer all in an HBO show. That sounds like an immediate hit, right? Like, incredible young star power. All of them are fantastic. Yeah, I know the show has a big kind of cult following on HBO. I know it covers some edgy themes that are apparently very hyper-modern to young audiences. Totally get behind that. Sam Levinson does seem to be a bit of a creep. Haven't watched it. Probably not going to watch it. Sure is interesting, though. If you watch Euphoria, write into the show and tell us about it, and we'll cover it. We'll read your thing on the TV Corner. It'll be great. One more to talk about. What do you got?
Beef. Season 2. Which was Beef season 1 was a sensation a couple of years ago that starred Ali Wong and Steven Yeun, who we know from Invincible, as two feuding neighbors. That was a really, really good, fun show. 8 episodes, big hit for Netflix. Season 2 is an anthology series, so we get a whole new cast for season 2, and it's star-studded. We have Oscar Isaac and a set of three couples. We have Oscar Isaac and Carey Mulligan, Charles Melton and Kaylee Spaney, and I can never remember the other two, but there's six
remember.
Like bigger yeah. names. But so I'm really looking forward to this. I really enjoyed the first season. It was really funny, and it was also very kind of heartfelt and had some serious kind of things to say about like modern suburbia. You had these two, you know, a stressed out working mom and a contractor guys struggling with family issues and their business, and they go at each other's throats. Last episode gets very Moses in the Desert, as they're very kind of David Lynchian, but it's a fun time. I'm really looking forward to season 2, which starts tomorrow, April 16th.
Yeah, fantastic cast. Love Oscar and Isaac and Mulligan. Love Melton and Kaylee Spaney. Heard some other podcasters in the film space being a little harsh on Kaylee Spaney recently. Not so. Come on. Give her a chance. All right. She's Priscilla. She did Alien Romulus. Like, she's doing Beef. It's coming along. Anyway. Yeah, I think Beef looks cool. I didn't actually finish season 1, which is it leaves me a little lacking here in being able to talk about what's happening here. I did really enjoy it. In particular, Steven Yeun's performance is really exceptional. I keep telling Andy there's a scene in a church in that first season. Really fantastic acting. He really does something special there. And I think there's an awful lot of talent behind what's happening here. Hopefully I'll be more into season 2. I need to check it out. When does it premiere?
Tomorrow, April 16th. I did want to mention, I remember reading this story where Ali Wong was talking about Steven Yeun as an actor, and she was like, he is so dedicated. And there's a scene where there's a car accident and his character has to like crawl out of an overturned car. And she said, you know, Steven Yeun's like down in the dirt on the road, getting scratched, getting like cut up, getting like, you know, really making it authentic. And she's like, I'm not getting down there. I'm not getting in the dirt. So, you know, he's just really dedicated. So yeah, we'll see what season 2 has to offer. And yeah, great, great cast. So that's TV Corner. Those are some of the big shows that are running right now. As it's spring, as we get into summer. So we'll see how we wrap up.
One more film to talk about on the podcast. I know this one came out a few weeks ago. Some people told us they had seen it already, maybe wanted to see what we thought. And, you know, in needing something extra fill in here, we thought, why not take a crack at it? Andy, you want to tell us what we're watching?
Crime 101. So this is a crime drama thriller heist thing from director Bart Layton, who previously did American Animals, a film that we did review and we did really like on this show. This stars the great Chris Hemsworth as a thief. He's a professional thief and he's very clean. He works fast. He's in and out. No violence, but a lot of threats. And he hasn't been caught. And he's just kind of really good at what he does. But he's looking for a way out. He's like, he can't do this forever. He needs one last score.
Hear.
He's being chased by Mark Ruffalo's He's Mark Ruffalo plays the police detective on the case. He's kind of the only one that thinks that there's this 101, this robbery or robber on the 101 freeway. That's where we get our title from. Some other actors that show up in this. Halle Berry plays an insurance adjuster for the uber rich and famous, and she is also involved because things get stolen, and she's the insurance person. And we also have some subplots, and well, I won't get too much into it, but it also includes Monica Barbaro, Barry Keoghan, Jennifer Jason Leigh. So a lot of characters, a lot going on. It's very Heat-esque. Like I said, lots of plot lines. You got your heist, you got your cops and robbers, your robbers and robbers, some romance thrown in there. Lots to talk about. Zach, what do you think?
Crime 101 is fine. I think Crime 101 is probably good, right? Like, I think it's a good movie. I think there are people out there that are going to enjoy it for sure. A little long in the tooth at like 2 hours, 12 minutes. I think the problem I have with Crime 101, it's a great cast. Like, I think the plot's fine. I think my problem is it just feels like a movie I've seen before. You mentioned that it's a lot like Heat, and it is like almost to a fault. And it's not just Heat. I feel like all of these characters, Halle Berry, Mark Ruffalo, Hemsworth, Barry Keoghan, they're all just playing like reflections of characters I've seen in other crime thrillers and heist thrillers. Combine that with a bit of a long runtime and a color palette that's like oddly muddled. I feel like American Animals kind of had this too. It kind of a funny muted color palette. This movie's kind of like golden brown a little bit, kind of grungy. If you're looking at the trailers we're covering it, you can see it on screen here. It just makes for kind of a long watch, and it makes for kind of a tough sit all the way through. Probably in theaters it would have done a little better. I think it would have gotten like, I would have held my attention a little bit more, but like I just kind of ended up struggling through this movie.
Yes, it's way too long. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes. Should be a tight 100 110, something like that. There's simultaneously too much and not enough going on. Like, this probably would have made a better TV show. And what I mean by that, like, there's way too many characters. There's way too many plot lines. I also left out Nick Nolte's in this, Corey Hawkins as well. So a huge cast, which means you don't really get enough time with all our players. And there's also, again, there's, you have the heist, you have the thief, you have thief versus thief, cop versus robbers, the romance subplot with Monica Barbaro gets like three scenes. She's criminally underused. The insurance agent also. So like Heat, there's five or six plot lines going on. You don't get enough time with all of them. It's like I said, somehow it's very long, but also you don't really get enough development. They needed to cut a few plot lines out of this, simplify it, make it easier, make it a little less Hollywood, I think. Tighten it up, and I think you would have had a better film. But it's so long, and there's just so much going on.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's based on a novella, right? It's not even based on a full novel, from author Don Winslow, who kind of wrote this as a send-up of like great heist films, great crime thrillers in fiction. So it lifts a lot of those, right? It ends up being this kind of mosaic of other properties that you've seen. And Bart Layton, director, who hasn't done a film since American Animals, like his last film, American Animals, is a heist movie. His previous film, The Imposter, kind of heist-esque, the idea of somebody like kind of secretly doing a thing with other people without knowing them. He had seen the book and liked it. And somebody said Hemsworth might be a good fit for it. And Hemsworth was really interested, and they couldn't get a hold of Winslow. And then Winslow ended up seeing American Animals at like an independent screening for something else, and reached out and was like, I love this movie. And so it's kind of just this perfect crossroads of these people who wanted to do this project and put it together and make something independent and special. I know Hemsworth is doing something different than his other roles, like for sure. He's kind of doing this American character, but he's he's doing Ryan Gosling in Drive, right? Like he's doing this like perfect buttoned up criminal who like always gets it right and has a schedule and has a system, and when things start to go wrong, it's tough. And like the challenge of this film is Drive is with Gosling the whole time. It's in the back seat. But here we only get him woven throughout parts. We get Halle Berry, who is this woman who is trying to get that promotion at work. And there's just all these male assholes on the board of directors who won't give her a chance. So she's got a chip on her shoulder. And Mark Ruffalo is playing kind of Al Pacino, right, in Heat, but without the drug use, and he's just miserable, and he's an inspector who hates his life, and like also lives in shades of Hemsworth's villain, who like has all of the life of luxury, but is miserable and unfulfilled. And then Barry Keoghan is like playing this maverick, goofy, devil may care sort of villain, anti-hero in there. And all of this makes for like a jewel heist movie that should be a lot of fun, but it just feels like you've just seen it before. You've seen all these scenes, you've seen them. Halle Berry getting screwed at the office and Chris Hemsworth being like, no, I've got my system. What am I going to do? And Mark Ruffalo like, curses, I'll get you next time. You know, like, I don't know. Yeah, like, because that's what the novella is, that ends up being what the film is. And I just feel like it lacks, while it does a good job of sending up all that stuff, like, it lacks an independence, like a real creative lightning bolt in the middle that makes it its own movie. Like kind of like what Heat, I keep saying, well, it's like Heat. I should not compare this to Heat. That's a ridiculous comparison. But it's an awful lot like it. It's shaped an awful lot like Heat.
Yeah, I mean, you've seen this movie 1,000 times in different permutations. Some things that where I feel like the studio kind of got involved. Chris Hemsworth, our protagonist, is kind of a little bit too nice. He's our thief with a heart of gold. He kind of is. That's an interest. Again, I'm going to bring a Heat comparison, but Robert De Niro's character is not a redeemable character. He is, you know, he's like, I will walk away from anything, a relationship, whatever, a friend, to like, get out, because that's what this life is. And he does that in this film. In this, you have like, well, he's trying to get out, and he strikes up a romance with Monica Barbaro, and you know, he tries to, you know, he's like a thief trying to do good, like a little bit of a Robin Hood kind of situation a couple of times. And it's like the film is like too scared to make our characters a little bit nastier than that. The like the good guys win, the bad guys lose. It's all fairly mundane.
I should say there are some bright spots in Crime 101 for sure. Action solid. Solid in the turns. And Hemsworth's a lot of fun in there. I do like the jewel heist stuff, like stealing diamonds and that kind of thing is very particular. And to hear it from Leighton, reportedly comes from a lot of reality. Like, not only did he work with Winslow with developing kind of these situations that Hemsworth finds himself in, and these heists where things got to be timed out perfect and we got to hop on the highway and get out of here. But also they went and talked to a lot of jewel thieves, right? The people who are incarcerated, failed jewel thieves often, right? But maybe a couple who are successful and still out there. And they got a lot of great stories that were able to kind of inspire certain parts of this. So like all that stuff feels real lean. It's those long drag out parts in between the action where you're like, okay, you're starting to reach for the cell phone. You're thinking, I want to get up and hit the laundry. You're watching at home. It's on Amazon Prime. It's not in theaters. So I don't know. Like, I think it's fine. Oh, also a special shout out to Nick Nolte, who's playing RFK Jr. in this. Dude, what happened to his voice? Somebody's going to tell me he got like throat cancer or something awful. And I'm sorry, I should look that up, but I didn't. It's so goofy. He's got a few scenes in here, and like, keep an ear out for Nick Nolte in this movie. My God, he is doing something special. Otherwise, Crime 101, any other thoughts? I don't want to wrap up recommendations, but
I mean, it's got a little bit of that streamer kind of feel to it, where like Jennifer Jason Leigh has exactly one scene. Like, she has a restaurant scene with Mark Ruffalo. And I feel like the whole movie is like that. All of our big names, they get one good scene.
Yeah.
And they're never seen again. We do get some decent action. We get some car chases. Barry Keoghan's character rides like a dirt bike, you know, and that's part of his character. He's like fast and loose and not as buttoned up and professional as professional thieves go. And so we do get opportunity for some action. It seems to just take forever. And even when it's happening, like the end is a big tense climax and kind of a Mexican standoff. And it's just like, let's get on with this. Like, how is this the climax, but still kind of slow and boring?
Yeah. Also, Mark Ruffalo has got to get out from doing like down on his luck investigator roles. I can think of like four, like David Fincher's Zodiac. He did that show on HBO. Like, I'm watching him in this movie, like, get out of a squad car smoking a cigarette with messy hair and being like, shut up, I'll be there in a minute. Like, walking up late to the crime scene, I'm just like, I've seen this so many times, Mark. Like, you gotta stop taking these, you know? Go be Bruce Banner again. Don't. It's fine. He's going to be Bruce Banner. Anyway, we need Mark Ruffalo to flex out. Poor Things. Delightful, Mark Ruffalo. Having a great time, right? What the hell are you talking about, Mark Ruffalo? More of that. More of that stuff, please. Hemsworth doing fine work in this movie. Andy, would you recommend Crime 101?
I would say save it for streaming. If you need something to put on the background, you know, take up the evening, watch with the fam, watch with the parents. It's perfectly safe. It's not too violent. We don't have any sensuality. we get action occasionally. Just it's so long and it's a little slow, but it's trying. It's got all the parts. It just doesn't really add up to much. So save it for streaming.
Yeah, Crime 101, fine heist movie available on Amazon Prime. $90 million picture. Amazon, as far as I know, did not make their money back. Maybe over time. People subscribe and keep clicking and watching and check it out. So if you want to see Chris Hemsworth in a heist movie, check out Crime 101. That's episode 332 Oscar Film Review. Good Lord. Already done and dusted. Now on to the next one. Now, what do we watch next week, Andy?
Next week, we're going to be taking a look at Mother Mary, which is David Lowery's follow-up to The Green Knight, starring Anne Hathaway as a washed-up or kind of aging pop star who no fashion designer will work with, and she goes to an old fashion designer who she's had a falling out with to design her dress. And while this sounds very camp, almost set up for a rom-com, there's something sinister kind of going on where this relationship will change both of them, and they'll never kind of be the same. Anne Hathaway looks really amazing for this role. Really excited about that. That's in theaters. And we're also going to be taking a look at Alpha, which is the follow-up from French director Julia Ducournau, who did Titan last, won the Palme d'Or for that in 2021, I believe. The Alpha was not very positively received, but I just have to watch it because she's a very exciting director. That's on video on demand on VOD, probably about a $10 rental. So those are the two we're going to be watching. Some FYI releases. Lee Cronin's The Mummy, which that is the full title. It's not The Mummy. It's Lee Cronin's The Mummy, like Bram Stoker's Dracula. Yeah. Comes out this April 17th. I don't know about this. I think this is another Blumhouse film. I don't know if this is going to capture horror audiences. The Mummy is possessing a young girl, and to me kind of doesn't look like it works, but it is coming out. Maybe the horror heads will support that. But for next week, Mother Mary and Alpha.
Yeah, really excited about Mother Mary. Just kind of a straight tone trailer. Like, honestly, Andy giving us the plot right there is kind of the most I've heard about the plot leading up to now. I don't want to know anymore. So that was perfect. Well done. Alpha looks awesome. Please write into the show if you do Lee Cronin's The Mummy. Like, I wouldn't mind hearing from somebody what's going on in that. That movie seems cool. So yeah. Well, not like super cool, but I'm curious. I'm skeptical, and if somebody writes in and says, "Oh no, it's awesome. Oh my god, y'all got to go see it," then I'm down. We liked Lee Cronin's Evil Dead script, right? Like when we saw that. We'll see. If you enjoyed the show today, if you like what we're doing here on Offscript Film Review, easiest way to support your boys is just subscribe to the show on your favorite platform. We're on YouTube, where we're uploading new videos all the time, having a ton of success over there. We're on all podcast platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, iHeartMedia, all the usual places you find your podcast. Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, Instagram, all usual social media spots. You can find us and follow us over there as well. Throw a like on a thing. Throw a comment on a thing. Let us know what you're thinking about. You can check out their website, offscriptfilmreview.com. You can write into the show directly from your lips to our ears or your keys to our whatever at mail@offscriptfilmreview.com. From all of us at Offscript Film Review, the home of Bold Cinema, I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Thanks for watching.